As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
So the 2021 Six Nations is finally over, but not before another brilliant, dramatic match in Paris, Scotland beating France to hand the title to Wales. Was this the best Six Nations ever, as Stephen Jones suggested in the Sunday Times? It looks like World Rugby will finally fund proper professional Pacifica teams in Super Rugby. Will it be enough to redress the balance between Tier 1 and Tier 2? And what are the implications for the rest of the global game? And Europe is back at the weekend. We'll preview the Champions Cup last 16. This is The Ruck. I'm Lawrence Dallaglio, and joining me today are Alex Lowe, Owen Slot, and our special guest this week, Mark Evans. Good morning, gentlemen. Mark, if I could start with you. Wonderful weekend of rugby. I mean, what were your highlights?
Well, the France-Scotland game was a belter, wasn't it? I still cannot quite work out what Doulin thought he was doing in the 81st minute when they couldn't get a bonus point and all he had to do was kick it 2 yards into touch. But it was a magnificent game. I think the French got a little bit caught a little bit between two stools about should we win it first and then think about the, you know, it was a little bit messy, difficult conditions though, but Scotland, all credit to them. I thought they'd been played well most of the tournament and they've got some monkeys off their back, haven't they? Won in the last year, they've won away in Wales, they've won in Twickenham, they've won in Paris, and they're doing it without using the same thin 15, 17 players like they have done traditionally. It's a very tight Six Nations. That's why it's been such a good tournament. With the unfortunate exception of Italy, you wouldn't say there's much between all five teams.
We could do a pod one day on just solely on most stupid things you've seen on a rugby pitch, and Bryce Doulin would be quite near the top, wouldn't he?
I have seen it done once before. Ben Botica did it for Quins against Northampton when that's all he had to do was kick it over the dead ball line, but he decided to go for touch and missed, and that was the game.
I'll tell you the one thing he didn't do was go and see Sean Edwards after the game. I'd be very surprised if he's managed to bump into him at all, actually, if he cares for his life. Owen, going from the most high-profile game to the one that you chose to go and watch over the weekend, as your writer's privilege as the chief correspondent in the Times. Where were you? 200 metres from your house or something? Was it Richmond against Saracens?
Yeah, no. Some people have wrongly assumed that I chose to go to Richmond against Saracens because the commute was sort of almost shorter than from my bedroom to the kitchen, but that would be very unfair. I went out of professional interest to see what it looked like to see Saracens, the recently European champions, play against a completely amateur side. Oh, actually, they're not completely amateur side because Richmond did have one full-time player who was their reserve hooker, who was a 21-year-old academy player at Harlequin. So I thought that was really interesting to go and cover. I think it's only right that we treat our readers to gifts like that, so that they rarely get. I mean, the Telegraph wasn't there, the Guardian weren't there. You know, other newspapers don't look after their readers like we do, and so it was only right that we did that.
Talk us through the game while you were there. I mean, I'm assuming you watched parts of it.
The game was fascinating because you do wonder when you see that, are you going to sort of be watching through your fingers? Is it going to be just one of those painful games like watching Italy play in the Six Nations every week? How completely are they going to get destroyed? And really, that didn't happen. Brilliantly, Richmond went 3-0 up after 4 minutes. And then they got so excited with themselves that given another penalty about 50 metres out 5 minutes later, they tried to kick that as well and came up about 10 metres short. But they managed to hold on to the lead till about, 29th minute when Jamie George, England and British Lions, sorry, British and Irish Lions. God, I'm offending a lot of people with that at the moment. Jamie George scored a try and then Saracens did slowly pull away, and the kind of things you expected, like collisions and scrums and stuff, started going increasingly their way. It was 32-3 in the end, but Richmond held their heads high.
Yeah, fantastic. And Alex, I mean, we're going to just do a quick Six Nations review. Obviously, just to remind all our listeners, Scotland's victory in Paris, of course, allowed Wales to win the Six Nations title. So France's search for a Six Nations championship goes on and on. England, well, finished fifth, one place above Italy. But Alex, just give us your sort of summation, really, just in a couple of sentences for each team, where the championship kind of went.
Well, I guess one of the things that interested me, the headline on a piece that Ian McGeachan wrote in the Telegraph, which was along the lines of Wales were deserved winners, but France were the best team, which seems on the surface kind of contradictory. But then that was exactly what we said last year, that England won the title, but France were actually the best team. And I think that's still what our sort of emotional sense is, that there's this wonderful, wonderfully attractive France team that is growing and growing. And I listed, you know, my top three games of the championship, and France were in all of them, as I expect everyone would probably have the same list. But, you know, Wales themselves accepted that they had the rub of the green a couple of times early in the championship, but I don't think you can win the Six Nations without being consistently good. And that's what's so intriguing about it for me, and Mark hit the nail on the head earlier. It's been the greatest Six Nations championships are the ones where there is no Grand Slam, and we had this circle, as you talked about last week, Lawrence, of everyone beating everybody other than Italy. And Sam Warburton was on our pod at the very start of the championship saying, listen, they don't deserve their place in the championship, and sadly they've done nothing to convince us otherwise. They've gone backwards. I mean, they've missed Jake Pelledri, obviously, but they've gone backwards. Scotland, I think, pretty harsh to finish fourth where they did, given the performances. But France, although they didn't win the title, were just wonderful to watch for me.
Mark, I mean, I remember when Warren Gatland came in to start coaching Wales with Sean Edwards, they won a Grand Slam. I think they won two in the first 3 years. Is there a feeling that France have missed an opportunity, not just this year, but last year as well? Because they are the coming team, there's no doubt about that, but they have actually blown the opportunity to win two titles in the first 2 years of their championship. Is that a little bit unfair, do you think?
No, I think it's a little bit unfair. They remind me a bit of the team you were in, Lawrence, actually. That England team of the late 90s, early noughties, who took quite a long time to translate. When they were, from memory, they were clearly the best team in the championship for quite a while. But it took them a little while to ice it. And I think that's where France are at the moment. I think they are in a very tight championship, and accepting that it'll always be hard to win for them in Twickenham and Cardiff and Dublin, and maybe even Murrayfield now, it is so tight. They are the best team. But that doesn't mean they're necessarily going to win it every year, but I think they will. It's quite a young side. The management and the coaching looks pretty stable and together, which is an important thing for France, because that's not always the case. And I'd be surprised if they didn't win it in at least one of the next 2 years. I'm not sure they'll do a slam. I think that's looking really difficult at the moment. In some, there used to be a time you looked at it and thought, well, if I've got my harder games at home and the easier ones away, there's a real opportunity there for a slam. I honestly don't think any of the teams can look at it like that at the moment, because where are the easy home games other than the one we're always talking about?
Do we actually think that France improved year on year from last year? I mean, last year they sort of, we effectively thought they sort of came from nothing and were just brilliant so quickly. So if they continued on that same trajectory, they would be World Cup winners, even though there wasn't a World Cup this year. They were that good. I kind of feel they plateaued. They didn't dominate long periods of games like they did in the previous year. And the final game in Scotland in particular, they started to look a bit more French than usual and started doing stupid things. Not just Doulin at the end, but they didn't quite have their heads around what they were trying to do.
Well, I mean, the first year's championship, obviously, you know, they one sending off cost them the title, didn't it? Cost them the Grand Slam. Mm. I do think they would have held on for that. And I think they've learned that to be the best side in the world, you need discipline. The COVID saga unravelled for them, really. You know, I thought they left Ireland, as you say, Mark, having not played brilliantly, but won for the first time in a long time. And whilst good old Bernie managed to sweep it all under the carpet very neatly, I think it had much more of an impact on them than possibly people think in terms of players. And it's been difficult Six Nations for everyone. You know, we'll get on to England in a second and quite why England decided to have such a strict COVID bubble compared to every other country. I think certainly tied Eddie Jones with one hand behind his back in terms of players he could pick and et cetera, et cetera. But Alex, for you, there were some standout players. Naturally, everyone's picking their Lions 15s and it were players that will go on that tour. I mean, we can't pick any Frenchmen, sadly. Otherwise, we'd probably pack it with a few. But I mean, Anton Dupont, you know, was outstanding again. I thought Hamish Watson had an outstanding championship, as did Faletau. I mean, who really stood out for you? Tadhg Byrne was another one that really came forward. It's going to be an interesting selection, isn't it, for Warren Gatland and his coaches.
I agree. You touched on the French players that caught your eye, and you mentioned Ficou, who I thought was outstanding all championship, and Dupont, obviously. I think Charles Olivant and Gregory Aldrete are just... we talk about how the management of that French team seemed to go a bit wild around COVID, but the leadership on the field, particularly from those two, I think is enormous and is what will drive them forward over the next couple of years. Outside of France and with the Lions, look at it. I think Hamish Watson. I thought previously he'd make the trip. I'm certainly should make the trip now. He was absolutely outstanding for Scotland, all championship. I thought Robbie Henshaw for Ireland really stood up. He went on the last Lions tour, didn't quite look like he was going to get in the test team, got injured. I think he's now a real front runner to play in the test team. And Tadhg Byrne has played himself onto the trip. And it was great to see Toby Faletau really back and sort of dominating. And I think he'll be the number eight again. In some ways, I don't think there'll be enormous changes to the starting 15 from the third test in Auckland in 2017, when it actually comes down to it. But a few have really thrust themselves into the mix, and Hamish Watson is on the plane. Tadhg Byrne for me, definitely. And Faletau nailed the number eight spot in my team.
If I throw one more in, I think Tadhg Furlong had an absolutely outstanding championship.
Yes, I agree. I agree, Mark. And actually, on your point about Mako, I thought just as Tadhg Furlong really stepped up, and I was helping Alex Corbisiero write his sort of guide to the dark arts, which we ran every weekend. And we were looking in depth at how Ireland scrum, and they use the Saracens model of the back five all start on their knees. And it's given them incredible solidity. Andrew Porter, who had binding issues in the autumn, suddenly looked picture perfect. Then Tadhg Furlong comes in and is outstanding. And that leads me on to what I was going to say about Mako, which is I just wonder whether they'll look at Mako World Cup final, Mako against Tadhg Furlong, and just start to worry about his scrummaging against the Springboks.
I this is going to sound biased, but if he'll go, I think they'll take Joe Marler.
I was going to say exactly the same.
I agree. It'd be whether he can face the trip.
Yeah.
And that long away.
And that's a bit that Lawrence's point about the tour is going to be in spades this time, because as I understand it, it's all in one bubble. There's going to be very, very little outside the hotel and the training ground. It's going to be like the cricket has been. It's going to be a long 8 weeks.
Maybe the fact that Joe Marler has given himself that kind of gap and not been part of England's bubble, which sounds like it was a pretty tough time. You know, maybe that's given him the breathing space to go, you know what, I can do the Lions. Maybe doing both would have been too much for him. Let's move on to England now, because you know, the talk of the town at the moment is Eddie Jones and the will he stay in the review. Because look, let's just be very clear. It was a really disappointing campaign for England. They finished fifth. They lost to Scotland, to Wales and to Ireland for the first time in many, many years. I think 1976 was the last time they did that. And they've only done it five times in the championship. So it's been a poor campaign. I just want to remind people to be careful what they wish for, really. And you guys will all know and will have a very strong view on this. And I'm interested to see where you are. But Wales last year, I think David Walsh mentioned this in his piece in the Sunday Times. Wales played 10 test matches last year, lost seven under Wayne Pivac. In fact, the only sides they beat were Italy and Georgia. And everyone was suggesting that Wayne Pivac was not the man to lead Wales forward, particularly after Warren Gatland. And of course, you know, in the space of an autumn campaign, he's gone from zero to hero. There were times in the last 24 months when Gregor Townsend came off the field, having watched his side get absolutely walloped a few times. In fact, he had the whole issue with Finn Russell. Can he actually manage players correctly? And I think his tenure was under the spotlight. Andy Farrell has taken time to win over the Irish public post Joe Schmidt era. No one's really sure whether he had the credentials to take them forward. And they, you know, are you the right man for the job? Was a question he was constantly asked. And I think the performance that his side put in against particularly England, I think has banished that theory. So where are we with Eddie Jones? Because I must remind all of you and myself as well that of any England coach, he has the best win ratio, including Sir Clive Woodward, who I have to gently remind every time we're in the studio as well. But clearly that's not good enough at the moment. Owen, you know, what's the timeline for this review and will it make any difference?
Well, first of all, about his winning record, his record in the Six Nations is worse than Stuart Lancaster's was. And we sort of look at the Lancaster regime as a poor period in England rugby.
Well, hold on a minute. He's won three out of the last five titles. So you say it's a worse ratio, but it's a ratio which has won titles rather than anything else. I'm not solely interested in people that, you know, that win titles, but I think it was. I don't remember.
Well, I was just telling you statistically that he wins that Lancaster won more games, had more wins per game than Eddie Jones did by a reasonable margin. Eddie Jones is on 66% and Lancaster was on 80%. So, I mean, yeah, granted, Lancaster didn't win titles, but he won four out of five every single time. So that's just some perspective. The review is going to be done, I suspect, probably next week, because we were told early April and they want to sort of announce their findings mid-April. So it's probably happening quite quickly. I think one of the things that concerns me about the review is they don't want to tell anyone who's doing it. And the one thing that we need here is some transparency, because clearly you could bring a load of people onto the review who are supporters or who work for the RFU or whatever, who would be interested in keeping continuity with what we've got. And you could have critics from the outside called Stuart Barnes and Stephen Jones and Owen Slott, and then he'd lose his job. So who's it going to be? Why not tell us and at least give the public some reassurance that there's going to be some independence of opinion on it?
Mark, you've seen pretty much everything that's happened in rugby. Succession planning has never been the RFU's strong suit. I think we can all agree on that. When Clive Woodward lost his job or parted company in 2004, I don't think England won a title for the next 12 years. So it's all very well saying, you know, it's time for Eddie Jones to move on. But actually, the fact that they've got no idea who would replace him or what sort of structure would replace him suggests that it's definitely not the time to move on. I mean, do you think there's a much bigger issue than just who coaches England right now?
I do, yes. So let's take the Eddie thing first. I'm not one of those people crying for his head. I think it's quite a tricky decision. There's a bit of a track record. Eddie's coached a long, long time, largely successfully, but not entirely. They still, you know, they still block him going into Queensland after that season. And his time at Saracens was patchy, to say the least. But nevertheless, he's got a lot of trophies under his belt. But you are judged in England. The player base is so large. It's not, I don't accept the, I think it's a false analogy between, let's say, Gregor Townsend at Scotland or even Andy Farrell in Ireland. England player base is so big that, you know, that the bar is quite rightly higher, and fifth is a long way below it. My issues with Eddie are, one is selection, which I do always feel is the absolute key skill of an international coach. Even with all the more time these days than there used to be, in a way, England have got so many players, selection becomes even more important than it does in some of the other countries. And I think he's been, some of the selection decisions have been strange. I'm not going to, you know, and I'm sorry, George Martin is going to be a great player, but that just looks, I'm not quite sure what the right word.
Well, it looks like he'd been on the port. That, you know,
well, it just looks like he's trying to make a point, which I don't think you do that in international selection, but there we are. And some of the communication stuff is just, it is just doesn't sit easily with people. But I think the really key thing is something England have never, ever got quite right. And this goes all the way back to Clive Woodward, who fought it like hell, and other people even before him. Unlike most other countries, the coach reports to the CEO. And in most sports, and in most, and in lots of other, that is not the case. And every time we've tried to bring it in, it's been fought against, funnily enough, by the incumbent coach. I thought the best one was when Clive fought like tooth and nail not to have
Chris Spicer
above him, and then wanted the job himself. I thought that was a particularly, once he was no longer the coach, I thought that was a particularly interesting point of time. But this is really about accountability. It's about who holds the head coach to account in any sports organization. Whose job is it to assess and then recommend whether the coach should stay or should go? And the problem sports have always is, if the CEO comes from a non-sporting background, that can often be quite tricky and difficult. And that's why an awful lot of sports will put a director of the particular sport in top. So, for example, I use a sport. So Tracy Neville was the coach when England netball won the Commonwealth Games, but there was a director of netball in the organisation, and she was her boss. And everybody knew that. But the coach still picked the team and did the media and all that kind of stuff. And I still wonder whether we've quite got that structure right. And I think that's why it's succession planning then, you made the point, Lawrence Longwick, is so difficult. You can't ask a person to plan for their own replacement. It just doesn't work.
Lawrence, can I ask you a question about the last few weeks with some inside knowledge of WASP? Do you understand what happened with Paolo Udogwu and a WASP disappointed with that?
Well, I mean, depends which way you look at it. I mean, Paolo Udogwu had a terrific game. I mean, he's a player who's jumped from club to club to club and never quite settled anywhere, maybe because the coaches felt they couldn't get the best out of him. It's pretty clear from the outside that Lee Blackett didn't see him as a top-class winger, but did see him as a player who maybe could play in the centre. He produced a magnificent performance, which won WASP the game against Bath, and Eddie Jones calls him world-class. No disrespect. I mean, that is an insult to some world-class centres. You know, I mean, he played well, admittedly, really well. But, you know, to call him world-class publicly and said, yeah, he can do things that no other player can do, and we're going to have a real good look at him. And then, so I think the language you use, it has to be measured. And I don't think in that context it was very well measured. Then he brings him into the squad, primarily to stop him getting capped for Italy, and then doesn't pick him against Italy when he's had a look at him in training. And then parachutes Joe Marchant ahead of him because, you know, I said, if he was world-class 5 or 6 weeks ago, how is he suddenly not world-class now? So I do think that, you know, to Mark's point, the selection has been baffling. It's been quite stubborn at times. It is the single most important criteria of any coach. And I don't think he's got it right all the time. And the more he hasn't got it right, the more he's dug his heels in and stuck to his guns. You know, dropping players does make a difference, particularly when they've got over 50 caps. You get the best out of them. And if you don't, then they're no longer for playing international rugby. So I just find it very strange indeed.
I think that the narrative around the selection has been really odd. So Eddie has been introducing the notion that this England team are in transition. which was something that Conor O'Shea railed against just last week and had a go at all of us for suggesting that this young England team was in transition, when all that we were doing was quoting Eddie Jones saying that England are in a period of transition. And when it was put to Eddie that this was the youngest team, you know, they made a big deal of this was the youngest team to reach the World Cup final 2019. Eddie's brought the average age down by a year to 27. And Eddie's saying, well, I need to know whether these players can make it through to the World Cup. Is there enough growth left in them? That's his perspective on, you know, can he get more out of Ben Youngs? Can he get more out of a George Ford? But you've got the director of performance at the RFU saying, be careful what you say about the transition. This is a young team. So there's a contradiction there. And on Mark's point about George Martin and why it felt like Eddie was making a point, I think that was backed up. If you watch the last episode of their in-house TV show called Inside Line, there's an extended passage in that 15 minutes where George Martin is being coached how to pick the ball up from the base of a ruck and drive the guard back or pick and go near the try line, sorry. And it feels like it goes on and on and on. And he's practicing with Ellis Genge, and Ellis Genge is giving him some tips on how to properly pick up and attack the defender. Like, this guy is supposed to be an international rugby player. Why have they spent this long period of what is a review episode of the Six Nations focusing on how they are coaching an international rugby player to do skills that you would expect him to have? And I think it's all part of this perception that Eddie's got to bring in all these young players. He's got to force this change through. And he does need to evolve the team, but that happens in every team. And just the way that it happens with England under Eddie is a boom and bust. You don't see that with New Zealand. They have a process to evolve a team a lot more effectively without suffering the peaks without suffering the troughs. And so I just think there's a lot of muddled messages going on from the team and from the RFU. The review that we talked about before, initially we were being told it would be 7 to 10 days. The meetings are already planned. They're not rushing anything forward, so there's no panic. And then Bill Sweeney says, well, actually, what's going to happen in May? But we recognise how urgent this is, so we've brought it forward to April. And, you know, obviously transparency is really important, but we're not going to tell you who's on the panel. And it's like, just there's a lot of confusing narratives going on, I think, around the team. And it just... When I think that the future is actually fairly straightforward, they've got a core of a team that needs to be evolved, and some players have been undroppable for too long based on form, not on age or anything else.
Enjoy more rugby insight and analysis throughout the season with the Times and the Sunday Times. Get a subscription today and get 1 month free. Search thetimes.co.uk/theruck for more details.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Again, some breaking news over the weekend that World Rugby has announced funding for two new franchises, Pacifica and the Fijian franchise as well, to compete in Super Rugby from 2022 onwards. I mean, this is seismic news, really. It's exactly what the game has been calling out for many, many years. Just to remind people, 25%, quite a staggering number, of professional players globally are from the Pacific Islands. And it's taken till 2021 for them to get the necessary funding.
I was really, really tickled by it, because we would all like to see what would happen if the Pacific Island nations were able to be as good as they possibly could be, and they've been nowhere near it for reasons we've talked about plenty. Then I started looking at that 1.2 million that World Rugby is putting into each of those teams a year. And I was thinking, well, I mean, that's great and everything, but that really is just Eddie Jones and Owen Farrell's income a year put together. So maybe we shouldn't go too overboard about this phenomenal bounty of generosity that's come their way. But if it gives them the opportunity to build as we think it can do, because the problem with the Pacific Islands at the moment is they find the young players because they like to play and they do have academies there. And there is a bit of a production line, but then there's very little in between that and the international game, which is why they kind of have to go abroad. So now, effectively, they won't have to go abroad. And there is a pathway, a seamless pathway, that should go through to the top. And it will mean the top players can play together almost all the time, and they won't be lost so much. And so, potentially, it's brilliant. But I think we now have to go to Mark Evans. When I heard this news, I rang Mark because he knows almost more about rugby than Alex Lowe. I said to Mark, you know, you've got the biggest brain in rugby. How brilliant is this news? And Mark stroked his chin a bit and said, pipe down, young fella. You don't quite know everything you're talking about.
A little harsh. I don't think I said that at all. That's not a direct quote. A couple of things. People over this part of the world have really got to stop saying that New Zealand and Australia nick all the Pacific Island players, because the vast majority of Pacific Islands are of heritage. They were born in New Zealand and they were born in Australia. It's a bit like saying Carl Sinclair should play for Jamaica, you know, even though where is it when he's from Wandsworth? You know, we've got to be very, very careful that we understand the situation. However, it's still fair to say that to strengthen the islands on the world stage, having a Super Rugby-based team in Fiji, because Fiji can probably just about support it economically, just about. I don't think, this is the point I was making to Owen on the phone, that the World Rugby grant on its own will not be sufficient. It won't. Okay, 1.1 million does not get you, even with lower incomes on the island. That will not get you with the travel and the rest of it. It needs the government to put some money into it, which I think the Fijian government probably will. And it also means that they need to be given a share of the television revenue that the competition generates. Because the big problem of the islands is there's only 1 million people on the island of Fiji, and half of them are of Asian heritage who don't tend on usually to follow the game. So you've got 500,000 in one island, and Samoa and Tonga are much, much smaller. So there is virtually no audience and therefore no broadcast revenue. So you are starting from a long, long way back. But I hear, and I have to declare an interest, I hear that I'm more optimistic than I have been for decades, because there is some movement in New Zealand in terms of in that regard. And if they can get it up for 2022, at least one team. I think one team will be in New Zealand. I don't think there'll be two teams on the islands. One will be in New Zealand. One will probably be on Fiji. If they can get through that, they'll need some private equity capital as well. They'll need three funding sources: government, private, and World Rugby. And that's always been the case. If you could get those three pots together, you've probably got enough to make a decent stab at it.
But yeah. World Rugby told me that they wouldn't have announced this funding if they didn't have it guaranteed that the other bits of funding weren't in place. Because if the others don't come into place, then World Rugby look pretty foolish. So, and admittedly, that has happened once or twice in our lifetime. So
I was going to say that's
a possibility.
A, World Rugby have been funding the islands for the last 10 years without those partners. So I'd like to know. And secondly, the point you made is, I've heard it before. I'd still like to see the contract before. Okay. I'm so passionate about it that I don't want to jump too early. It is very, very good news. And it's, I think I said to you, pretty necessary, but not sufficient. And that's where I am with it at the moment. It's great news. I just hope it can be built on.
Isn't there a lesson here as well for other areas of potential growth in the global game? And I'm talking about the US in particular, because I think the US will be granted, if they haven't been already, the opportunity to host the Rugby World Cup in 2032. I think Silver Lake, whose deal of buying a small percentage of the All Blacks is not a fait accompli. That has to be voted, and I know there's objection to that in New Zealand. But part of that deal will be then buying two MLR franchises as well, and strengthening the growth trajectory of rugby in the US in the lead up to 2032. And I'm sure that they'll divert some of that Olympic funding too. And my question also is around Italy. You know, everyone looks at Italy and says, oh, you know, why can't they be good enough to be in the Six Nations? You know, just putting them in a tournament and just expecting it to happen is not enough. If you were to award Italy a Rugby World Cup, for instance, and you were to do that in, I don't know, 8 to 12 years time, and then you were to build a proper plan around that sort of that trajectory towards the tournament, which involved government funding, which involved World Rugby funding, which involved a proper structure, I think Italy, and then it still failed, then I think you'd have that, you know, decent grounds for saying, well, we've tried in Italy and it hasn't worked. But just to employ a coach and expect him to wave his magic wand for 4 years and then, oh, that didn't work, so let's just employ another coach, I just think is a crazy method. So I do think there's huge opportunity with this Pacific Island news. I think America is definitely another area that World Rugby should be looking at. I'm sure they are looking at. And Italy, closer to home, you know, I think it's a huge opportunity that's currently being untapped and missed.
Well, I'm trying to work out if I'm still going to be in a job when the World Cup goes to America. That's something to aim at and to keep you sharp, isn't it?
I think it's almost a done deal. I'd say 2031 in the USA is almost a done deal. Everybody you talk to says it's 27 in Australia, it's 31 in the States. And the big difference here between is the States don't need capital. That one thing the United States has got, many things, but one of the things it's got is there are huge amounts of capital swirling around that country, and they are prepared to invest and fail. I mean, they don't care about leagues that try and fail. They just see it as part of the way that things are. I agree that Silver Lake's investment, once agreed, I think it will be, will be a bit of a trigger. And you know, there's Australian investment in MLR already into the Los Angeles franchise. Now they're not short of capital. They are short of a competition. It's Italy. I wish we'd take the World Cup to Italy. I was arguing for it 20 years ago. One, it's got the stadia, it's got the population. But what worries me is I know that Italy have been offered the Heineken Cup final a couple of times, which I thought would be a good start, and have said thanks, but no thanks.
If we just agreed to give Italy the World Cup every World Cup, would that make it all right to take them away from the Six Nations? Just to, like, balance it up a bit. So you're not going to be in the Six Nations, but we love your country, so we're just going to have the World Cup there every time. Would that be okay?
I know that their performance in the Six Nations is really disappointing, and it looks like there's no progress whatsoever. And I don't know enough about the detail of Italian rugby to really comment on that. All I do know is that we have invested so much in Italy, and it's a large country, and there is a market, and I'd be really loath to give up on that, because two reasons. One, Georgia's the next best, and Italy beat them every time they play them, right? That's the first point. And secondly, rugby hasn't got many countries with lots of people in them. You know, the argument that rugby is a game for small nations and minorities has something of the truth about it. And Italy, at least, there is a foothold. And I know it's frustrating. I know people hate it. But I would be really low just to walk away from that after all that we've tried to put into it.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. The other massive area of growth in the game is in the women's game. And England begin their defence of the Women's Six Nations Championship against Scotland in Darlington. I think they're going for their third Grand Slam in a row. For the first time, the competition will be played in a separate window to the men, which in itself is unique. But there'll be, because of a lack of fixtures, and this is one of the perennial problems of the women's game, they've split into two shortened formats of two different pools. And, I mean, I guess, Alex, it probably, you know, no matter what we say about it, it probably still looks likely that, you know, there'll be two pools, England will probably meet France in the final and in the decider, won't they?
Yes, I think they will. I was talking to Giselle Mather last week, Wasps ladies director of rugby, and the way she describes it is this is the COVID Six Nations. It'll follow the similar format to the men's Autumn Nations Cup, as you say, two pools and then a sort of finals day at the end. I don't think the players and the countries involved actually want this format to continue because it's fewer matches. But they do like the idea of having their own window, which it allows them to breathe in their own space, to get more attention outside of the men's Six Nations. But one of the big issues is in the women's game is the disparity between the fully pro England team, the French team, who I think are technically semi-pro, but are much better funded, and they play in front of sell-out crowds when crowds are allowed in, down to Ireland and Scotland, who are amateur, I believe, or certainly largely amateur, as international teams. And that's an issue. It came up recently when it was announced that the Lions were going to run a sort of feasibility study into the idea of running a women's Lions team. And how do you pick a Lions team to go on tour when so many of the players will have other jobs and are only semi-pro? And would it be even dominated by England because they're professional? All these issues that the women's game is trying to solve, but the fact it's had to delay its World Cup by a year puts even greater emphasis, I think, on the Six Nations, because it's a great chance for these players to take the international stage. They've waited so long for it, and I think some of the Irish players haven't played at all since lockdown. So it's welcome, and we look forward to it. But there's a lot of growth to be done in the women's game.
Agree with that, and good luck to England and all the other teams taking part. Sarah Hunter, of course, back from long-term injury to be leading England. Before we go to our god or goddess of the week, which will give you time to think about that, I want to just propel ourselves forward to this weekend, because Europe is back on the agenda. This wonderful last 16 that we now have, so slightly different format. And I guess unique in the sense that we now have last 16 and we already know the draws for the quarterfinals as well. So we've got 2 weeks of European rugby, which might explain the reasons why Rob Baxter, the director of rugby at Exeter, decided to select what was effectively his second 15 choice in the Premiership last weekend. He's well within his rights, because his champion side, Exeter, European champions, will be facing Lyon on Saturday. Some mouth-watering ties, gentlemen. Leinster, Toulon kicks us off on Friday. Gloucester, La Rochelle, Wasps, struggling in the Premiership, take on the machine that is Clermont Auvergne up at the Ricoh. My pick of the ties was it is Munster against Toulouse. I think that's just an absolute belter. Toulouse, of course, beaten by Exeter in the semi-final last year. Can they go one better? The Exeter Lyon, and then of course Racing Edinburgh. I guess another intriguing one: Bordeaux Begle against Bristol. Bristol flying high, but Bordeaux themselves going quite well. And then rounded off with Scarlet Sail. Mark, where are you going to cast your eyes over the weekend?
I can't go past Munster Toulouse for the tie of the weekend, and that is going to be an absolute belter. I think, looking at the draw more generally, I think the French clubs look really well positioned. I can't see Gloucester beating La Rochelle, and I can't see Wasps beating Clermont, and I can't see Edinburgh beating Racing. I think those three will go through, and they don't play each other into the way the draw has been drawn. So in advance, as it were. I think Exeter will beat Lyon, and they're so hard to beat at home. But then they've got to play Leinster or Toulon, which is going to be that'll be the quarterfinal tie of the round. It's really interesting. Will Bristol beat Bordeaux away? That would be a hell of a win. That really would be a hell of a win if they can do that. That would show me that I think they probably are already, but that would be a real step up for them.
Well, they certainly won, having been losing in the last minutes of games in consecutive weeks. They've shown this kind of ability to dig deep when not necessarily playing at their best. And as you say, they're going to need to do that. But I think I'm inclined to agree with you. English club rugby's best chance probably starts at Exeter and finishes at Bristol. I think if they make it through, both of them will end up with home semi-finals, which again is enormous in terms of that. So the incentive and the carrots are there for both those two sides. Slotty, where are you heading? I mean, more than 2 miles up the road this weekend?
Yeah, probably Saracens Doncaster. That's the big, big round. Actually, sorry, that's a couple of weeks away. I don't know. You've named all the really big games. I normally go to a game on a Sunday and do the couch potato version on the Saturday. So you
can have the Challenge Cup then. I mean, there's Harlequins Ulster maybe on the Sunday, on Sunday the 4th. I mean, there is some big ties in the other.
Now you're teasing me because it's another walk away, isn't it? Okay, that's me decided. I'll do Harlequins on. That's at 8 o'clock on Sunday night, actually, isn't it? That'll work quite nicely. A whole day off, and then
if you can survive the food coma from Sunday lunch, you should be able to get down there in time. Arthur, where are you heading to, or where are your eyes looking?
I like the Bordeaux Bristol fixture because I covered the reverse game in the Challenge Cup semi final last season, which Bristol came from 13 points down and then won it in extra time, and it was a great occasion. It got them to their first European final. Which they then went on to win. So having seen that game and been at Ashton Gate filing on deadline in a game in extra time, it sticks with me. So I'm quite keen on watching that game on Sunday, which obviously we can't go to because it's in France. So that will be a sofa job on Sunday afternoon. So other than the obvious games that you've all mentioned, that's the one that intrigues me because I think as Mark said, it's a big test to go and do that away from home. Even without crowds and all that kind of stuff. It's a test of Bristol's mettle, and they passed it in the European Challenge Cup semi last season. Champions Cup knockout is a different matter. So, yeah, I'm keen for that one.
Well, listen, we've got some amazing rugby, whatever happens, coming up over the next couple of weeks. And if it gives us the kind of dramatic finishes that we've seen in the recent Six Nations, we'll all be very, very happy. Gentlemen, we will finish with our God or Goddess of the Week. I'm sure you've all been thinking long and hard. Alex, how about you kick off?
My nomination is John Inverdale.
I wish I'd said that. can I go, Lawrence, can I go first?
No.
There's a lovely interview with John in the Sunday Times, which will obviously still be available online with Stephen Jones. He loves rugby, first of all. He played rugby. He's now stepping down from BBC's rugby coverage because he's been invited to join the RFU Council. And having, as he said, having sort of thrown stones from the outside and called for change, he's now been given an opportunity to step in and try and make things better representing community rugby. I just have these great memories of him presenting Rugby Special when I was growing up. And in fact, one of the things that sticks to mind as a very amateur broadcaster, as everyone who listens to The Rock can tell, I remember being at the Open with my dad up at Troon. My dad knows him a little bit. And he was walking down the fairway with his big battery pack on, headphones, clipboard in front of him, hosting Five Lives coverage from the middle of the fairway, linking from John Murray on one green to Andrew Cotter on another green. And he threw over to a reporter, wandered over to the ropes, had a quick chat to my dad and I, and then just sort of put his hand up, calls a halt, brought a halt to the conversation, threw back to another reporter on another green, and then carried on the chat again. And the ability to just ooze calm and control of this broadcast while he was in the middle of the fairway, having a chat to a few people along the rope was just remarkable. And great rugby guy, a great broadcaster. So
yeah, wonderful choice. Owen, as the chief rugby correspondent for the Times, you can go second.
Well, I'd just like to say I'm really cross that Alex came up with John Inverdale first, because I was going to say him, my second nomination. It is even though the French tossed their Six Nations away so stupidly, I've just been slowly falling deeper and deeper in love with one of the French players, and it's not Dupont or Jalibert or Ficou or any of the ones that everyone else just loves. I am just increasingly smitten with Julien Marchand, their hooker. I just want him to be my mate. I want him to come round for Easter, and I want him I just think he's an outstanding player. I couldn't believe he got picked ahead of Camille Chat, but now I get it every time. He's got all the skills. He can do the basics. He can turn over ball. He can pass. He can run. He can come round to mine for Easter and celebrate what it is like being a great French rugby player.
Mark, just get rid of this man love and bring some common sense to proceedings, really.
Well, I mean, I'd go with John Inverdale as well. But if I wasn't, I had about three. I think Hamish Watson is, that's maybe not just for this week. I just think he's been absolutely top class through the whole competition. And consistency, I've always been a great. I mean, anyone can put the odd flash game together, but to do it week in after week after week after week is just incredibly impressive. But yeah, if it wasn't Johnny, I'd go for Hamish Watson with a mention for Damian Penaud, but only because I used to remember as a 2-year-old running around Bramley Road after his dad, and it's just nice to see the generations come through. And he has played in a very good French side. He has played some terrific stuff on the wing, and he's pretty handy in the centre, but he can't get in there.
Yeah, listen, I think that's a wonderful choice, and I've got a bit of a man love going on with the performance of a player who hasn't played in the Six Nations, but I was down at Ashton Gate for the Bristol game, and I had no idea how good, or I was just amazed at how well Danny Kerr played in that game. My God of the Week goes to Danny Kerr, because when a player gives up international rugby and he's had a long innings and really kind of knows that his goose is cooked and he's probably unlikely to get picked again for his international side, but has still got the ability to lift his performance to the very top of international rugby. I mean, he looks like a real top-class player. And who knows, he may end up raising the attentions of Warren Gatland and the Lions coach. But I think my God of the Week goes to, and there was many, many good performers in that game, but just his all-round performance, Danny Kerr on the losing side for Harlequins.
Oh, some great nominations there. Danny Kerr, spot on, Lawrence. Yeah, Hamish Watson, but Julian Marchand, actually, I'm just sticking with him, yeah.
That's why you're the chief rugby correspondent.
Indeed.
Yeah, over-emotional today.
My thanks to Owen Slott, Alex Lowe, and our special guest, Mark Evans. The Ruck returns on Monday with Europe very much on our minds. If you've enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a review, and you can subscribe on Acast, iTunes, or your usual podcast provider.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com